not yet materialized.
That's all right, man.
I am going to impose upon Dr. Parrish to come and be subjected to whatever remarks you may have, and I believe there are those persons who were formally asked to react. Dr. Riggins Pearl and Dr. Charles Brown and Dr. Lillian Ware. There may be some who do not know Dr. Ware in her current capacity. She has recently come to Clark College, my undergraduate school, as the head of the religion department, the Department of Religion and Philosophy. And we look forward to her moving that department into deeper intellectual waters. And I'm sure that that is indicative. They have just recently honored one of our own, Dr. C. Eric Lincoln, who was once professor of social philosophy at Clark College, and in its administration shortly, with a lectureship named in his honor, the C. Eric Lincoln Lectureship at Clark College. That is an endowed lectureship, and it was partly because of the moving spirit of Lillian that that was achieved. Also to say that we welcome her into the community, the larger community of Atlanta, as one who lends strength to those of us who collectively practice the academic at the or in the discipline of religion, or in the many disciplines of religion. And I'm sure that she will learn something. I took a little moment to say that about her because she was engaged in another capacity in relation to the lectureship this week, and that has precluded her from being a part of our ongoing deliberations. I'm going then to just rely upon these persons to come in the order that they are listed. And say what they would like to say in terms of as a reaction to Dr. Parrish's paper, and then we will all go into discussions. We are checking on Sheridan. He was in the hotel at Americana, and we are not sure. It's not like him. So we are concerned about whether or not he is all right.
Did you check on Chuck too?
On
Chuck Long? Did you check on him too?
Yeah, that wasn't bad.
I'm Rickin' Gerald.
Some of us know Chuck Long, not to check.
How do you vote?
It doesn't matter. No, it doesn't. Either way. He checked out this morning, out of the hotel.
Yeah. And he's all right.
He's all right.
Go ahead, Rick. Your name is down.
First of all, let me, in the 3 minutes given,
take your time, Doctor.
Acknowledge my appreciation, and I'm sure the group's appreciation, to
Harris for lifting up to us this morning in this presentation a problematic that becomes more and more obvious as we reflect on it. It's been said that there is one of the attributes of genius, of certain kinds of genius, is to make known, make obviously known the obvious. And that's very difficult in scholarship. It sounds easy, but it's very difficult to clearly state in crisp terms and a kind of clear and complex way, the complexity of the problem as it emerges in Afro-American religion. Now, Peter has admitted that he's only given us chapter 5, and that creates a problem in terms of responding to his paper also, because without a knowledge of the other chapters, our responding would be somewhat a feeling approach. But let me respond to the problematic. I'm still wrestling, Peter, with your notion of communal power. If you use this as a topology or a construct, in what way could it not be argued from the other side that the white community also understands that it has communal power, and its communal power is just as humane, just as moral, as the communal power that you want to assign to Afro-Americans? You've admitted that communal power is not void or absent of unilateral power. So in what way, what is there about communal power, even as the Afro-American church has understood it, that gives it a certain kind of distinction in the Afro-American or in the larger community? There are white churches who would claim that they have also been advocates of brotherhood. And you could say, well, in what way? And they said, well, we preach brotherhood. We preach the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. In what way has the Afro-American church, beyond its rhetoric of brotherhood, the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God, in what way has it moved to make the larger community more cognizant of communal power as being something that would transform the larger community? Maybe this is an unfair question in the sense that in some way you have answered this, but I'm still not real clear, because if power is relational, if it's the power that you're talking about now is communal, it's the property of Afro, in the sense that it's communal, it's the property of the Afro-American religious community, or the possession of that community. Then I take it that what you mean by this term is, and this is what I heard, is that the Afro-American community has gained this power by losing it. As it loses itself to the white community, it gains communal power. The communal power comes through a self-giving, or giving up of itself to the majority community. Uh, apparently in your previous chapters you probably deal with this, but I'm concerned again about how this notion of power comes in the first place in the Afro-American community, because there is a struggle in the black churches of the Afro-American community. There is a kind of unilateral quest among independent churches in the early history of the country for different territories. Baptists making claims on this territory, this denomination making claims on that territory. In other words, don't you get within under this concept of communal power, don't you get the unilateral self-interest of independent groups, that conflict in the struggle, there are certain internal struggles and internal warfares within denominations. I think of the AME and the AME Zion, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I imagine my 3 minutes are almost up, but is anybody keeping time?
Yeah. I think they're gone.
Well, since there is a sense of power in the black community that you don't respect time. I also wonder what kind of understanding of, how does this inform our hermeneutics now for your conflict model? How does it inform our hermeneutic for interpreting the ethical principles of the New Testament and the Old Testament? Thank you.
I'd like to express my appreciation to Peter for the work he's done and for providing the opportunity for some of us to respond. One of the best contributions that Joe Washington made to black religious scholarship was he wrote Black Religion and got folks stirred up to say, well, no, wait a minute, and got them made it necessary to say some other things.
That's right.
As well as provided a very valid and important principle that had to be a starting point. And I think Peter has done the same for us here in this work, Social Teachings in the Black Churches. In the first place, I would like to make a comment on what I suppose or see his method as being. The method that seems to be utilized is a descriptive and expository method, which I think performs a task and function of generating data. Part of the problem is we don't have the data to deal with, and so in the process of doing the writing, he had to generate the data, which he interprets, and then in that way, the interpretation itself becomes a part of data. And that is a very helpful and very significant task. On the other hand, one of the issues that is raised in this method is the empirical base then that supports the data as facts, etc. And I'll have a comment to make on that later on. In the discussion on power, one of the things that occurred to me from the outset is the need to break down the understandings of power in the black church into theological and institutional aspects, because we have both. And especially when you talk about the capacity to undergo effects. I mean, theologically, we have, I had a deacon in the church I served once in Boston, Massachusetts, who would always pray, Lord, you can open doors that nobody can shut, and you can close that nobody can open. And it was a way of talking about a power that was available to a people put in a position of suffering to undergo and not be destroyed by certain effects, so that if there's anything left for them to exercise it, that's also there. But there is that theological dimension. And I think one of the concerns in black theology is how do we give more force to that part of the concern, not only of undergoing, but the constructive exercise and expression of power, which is still being worked on. But at least the breakdown would be helpful, because I think that would tease out some additional data. Now, one of the things that occurred to me also as we progressed was the fact that economics are not dealt with in this conception of power at all. And you just can't talk about power on the American scene without talking about economics, because that is the leading force in power, not only socially or politically, but also culturally, because the limitation even on cultural expressions. I mean, we just had it with the whole charge about Martin Luther King being communist. I mean, the cultural norm and values, not only in terms of economic ideology, but theologically, the last thing you can do is be communist. So that I just think that it's a part, since power is explicitly, we don't talk about Bill DeVoe when we were students together at Boston. I was talking to him about this whole, about the Black Power movement, and he made the observation, being connected with the military, he said, well, the people who have power don't talk about it. And the most powerful sector of American society is economic society, and the very fact that there is silence on that power is an indication of how powerful it is. So that it seems to me that there needs to be some attention to that matter. In terms of the discussion about weapons, the fact that the blacks have utilized the religious and political ideals of the dominant culture and society, and I think that is quite true. I think there's also a point of difference involved here, and it's found in Martin Luther King's statement, we're only asking you to be true to what you put down on paper. That is a fundamental difference in the mobilization, the utilization of these religious and political ideals, is the insistence on their implementation. The refusal to just take these within the commonly understood practice of American society of setting up a polarity or a tension between the real and the ideal, and say, well, the ideal is nice, but we're doing the best we can do, and we have achieved the best possible society, so we need do no more. And if more could be done, we would be doing it, kind of a thing. And that's been the framework in which blacks have always worked. But the crucial difference here has been insisting on implementation, that is confronting that understanding of that tension on both the spiritual, material, and the political, social planes. Peter also used the notion of black churches, and when he said that black churches have been opposed to migration and revolution, I began to think that here's the point at which the methodological question and the question of the empirical base becomes kind of crucial, because there are certainly some organized forms of black religion which have advocated both migration and revolution. And it seems that the concept of the term, the designation black churches, is being reserved for certain established black churches, AMEZ, AME, Black Baptist Conventions, etc., and does not include the religious expressions that came out of Margaret Garvey's movement, and etc. And here, I think that we need to raise the question, how broadly or narrowly conceived is this designation, and what would be contributed by acknowledging that there are, in fact, differences among organized forms of black religion, and developing a typology. And here's where Trelch's method, which is implied in your title, is very useful and necessary, because it becomes the way for organizing and interpreting the differences that are found in the concrete data, and resisting the temptation to compress them all into a single identification. So here's where that really presses in, and where the where a typology, I think, would be of tremendous assistance. I think I had one other comment, and that had to do with the matter of self-interest. statement is made that blacks have rarely seen themselves as a narrow self-interest or self-interested group. And I would say that is not only a matter of an internal control or resistance, but the fact that that internal resistance is the result of a forcefully imposed limitation on forms of black self-expression. And that when blacks come to terms with the threat that is the price to be paid for breaking the stereotyped relationships with whites, that constitutes the kind of dynamics for that barrier. And it is the continuing problem. And it has a lot to do then with that tension of relationship between black churches and black theology, although it has something else to do with the fact that black theology in its expression has emerged primarily out of academic context, and there's been that ongoing conflict between what emerges out of the academic context and the religious communal context, which we saw going on yesterday when we had the different reactions between the people who were pastors and the people who were scholars, academicians in their response, for example, to Evans Crawford's paper, etc. So that matter is very much there. But I would want to say that it is important to give a role to those forcefully imposed limitations on black self-expression as having something to do with the self-interest part of it. And I'm reminded, for example, of Gayrod Wilmore's criticism of Martin Luther King in some of his writing on that as one of the points of raising that from within even established black religion. And on the other point I made about economics, I'm reminded of Cornel West's work, Prophesied Deliverance, and his particular focus on that as well.
I guess so much of what I was thinking has already been expressed, but as historian, basically, I think I probably do have something of a somewhat different perspective. I, too, want to commend the redefining, reifying of power and applying your other people have gone back and gotten smaller bits of the picture. And I just wondered what possibility there is of your making your study more inclusive so that it gives us a more credible and valid conclusion or interpretation. I also was somewhat concerned about not feeling your sense for history. I felt that the canvas either was too small or wasn't used, there also, in addition to there not being enough pieces placed upon it. Although my name is not included in any roster of feminists, and I probably consider something of a bane to them often, because I insist that I be more inclusive and widespread in my own studies. I did recently finish a work which will be in Rosemary Ruther and Keller's book on women and religion in America, Volume 2, which is the colonial period and the revolutionary period. I did a piece for them, Black Women and the Colonial Period. And in conducting that research, I got the feeling that we'd started out as a country. And I couldn't tell where you started. You know, I couldn't tell the time. But I felt that we started as a country, for example, with certain central ideals and values, Christianity. And that probably in the revolutionary period, well, this is not in that piece, I'm sorry. I'm doing two pieces on the revolution. But that in the revolutionary period, while we had these values, Americans were probably more Christian, or the colonists were probably more Christian than they had been any other time. But at the same time, they were also as racist and more violent than they've ever been. I just kind of think that these kinds of contradictions will have to be dealt with inside the piece. You said, for example, the black conversion was preceded by black independence and Christian reform. And I wondered if you meant institutional reform. I couldn't understand or follow some of those terms. Let's see. I also did not think that the churches, the black churches being nonviolent, was necessarily inconsistent with its having self-interest, promoting its own self-interest. But I don't have the manuscript before me, and I don't know enough about the supporting items. So I just don't want to belabor the point, but there are a lot of other questions I do have about various pieces. The black male preacher is shaping his constituents. And I wondered also about economics, and that was one of the pieces I meant about the canvas, not only time, but in terms of politics, economics, and of what we are talking about when we talk about self-interest and what we're talking about when we talk about the black church. The black church and its social teachings, I think properly said. But then where do you delineate between social teachings and theology of the church? As for example, I don't agree with Charles that we have insisted that the church should live up to its central values and ideals of Christianity. I think we've only held them up there. I don't think the church has insisted that society should. I think the church has reminded us that they're there and that we should aspire to them, but has somehow said we never can really quite reach them. And therefore, we started out as a nation with this kind of contradiction and compromise. We've got the values. We fought for them. We fought not to be enslaved. We fought against tyranny. But now we're free, so we do what we need to do to promote our own selves.
Let me say a couple of things, which I think may help a little bit. I said at the beginning, I was aware of the difficulties in taking virtually the last chapter. The limitations that I'm placing upon myself is that I really am studying, I should have said this, I really am studying the three major Methodist and Baptist denominations. The empirical base is the minutes and speeches and addresses and so forth of the officials in those denominations.
What
and
period?
Selectively. It is largely from 1890 to the present in terms of going through those speeches, those kind of primary materials, and then trying to bring some kind of interpretive framework to bear on what was going on in those assemblies. Now, that limits, the study is limited to that.
Now, one has to limit. May I be clear now? What? Your book is the social teaching
of the black church
from 1890.
Well, I have not put a date in the title. But the, now, the, because I do not want, I'm not really working as a historian. I'm using and reflecting on historical material, but I'm not trying to present myself as a historian.
One more question. Now, is the book a book of sociology?
It is not a book of sociology. It's a book. Now, I have not sort of rigorously limited myself to that period, but in terms of my own readings in preparation for those are the materials that I spent a great deal of time reading, and I read various autobiographies and written materials of various bishops and presidents and things like that. The idea is trying to get at the most basic value that shaped the life of these churches. And
Peter,
then I'm on, yeah, and I, yeah, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, but can you do that without being historian?
Well,
can you do that without being interdisciplinary in your approach? I mean, I'll just ask that.
The only difference, I mean, I'm saying that I am using historical materials. I am not a historian myself, and I do not want to trust
But don't you have to be?
Don't I have to be a detective?
Yes.
I think the answer to that is no.
No, I don't think
it is? Okay,
he
explain
can
that
be,
to
he
me.
He can be anything he wants to be. The question is whether or not what is the product is adequate.
Well, that's all I'm
usage
asking.
And so forth that persons want to put it to. No, you're putting in an imperialism here,
uh-huh.
Saying that one must be a historian in order to use these materials and to tease from them a certain
I'm not saying that. I'm saying one must be interdisciplinary.
Well,
and so that we get
okay,
a broader, get an understanding that is more valid and more credible.
Well,
see, for example,
the social ethics by its definition is interdisciplinary.
Well, he just said, well, that's what I thought.
By interdisciplinary, I don't present myself as an interdisciplinarian, which I don't think is anything. I present myself as a social ethicist who draws upon resources of philosophy, of sociology, history, primary, and so forth. That's all. But I think that it is for a historian to say that I have distorted history or I have not looked at certain kinds of things that I should have looked at in order to make my case.
Okay.
But that remains the criticism that needs to be made by.
Yeah, that's what
I'm
saying.
Are you attempting to have him contextualize?
I'm attempting to do just what he just said.
But he has to. Date it might be that his theologizing or
no.
As a Christian ethicist, he's not really within that framework.
Yeah, Dr. Jones, no. I'm suggesting that to start at 1890 is too late, or maybe too late. And I would like to know what happened before that, or what did this degenerate into, or what did it progress from?
You see, I start with, and this may be wrong, and may be severely criticized for doing this, I say that what has gone on from 1890 to the present, I've got to limit myself because I can't really take on the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
what
right.
goes on from 1890 to the present is significantly connected with a past. That is, these things, you read something, speeches or whatever, or sermons, presidential addresses in 1895, those are not sort of materials that are limited to 1895. They build upon a tradition. And therefore, I make generalizations about the tradition that these things stand in. Now, this may be wrong. One may say, you cannot make that judgment.
Just ask this, I know you're in the midst of your response in this question, but just on this issue, we have not had the benefit of the previous four chapters, so we don't know what you've done in them. In those four chapters, or in your introduction, do you make clear that you are picking up something midstream and moving from there, recognizing the past, or do you do that?
Yes, I am. The topics now of the chapters are, one, the first chapter is the Black Churches, a surrogate world. And there I'm dealing with the Black Church independence movement that provided a new world for blacks. You know, and it's a surrogate world. They were not able to participate in them. And so that picks that sort of deals with a bit of the invisible church, and then we have the visible, you know, institutionalization, the founding of the AME churches, and so forth and so on. And then the second chapter is the Black Church's autonomy in dilemma. And there, I'm talking about the churches have been loyal to two things. One, they've been loyal to the nation, and they've been loyal to the race. And that has provided the churches with a dilemma. And that's been in conflict. And there I pick up on and building on Du Bois's notion of the two-ness, and saying that two-ness has led to a dual morality, because the race and the nation were in conflict at a certain level, but yet, and the churches were loyal to both. And when the church gives its focus to racial matters, it in officially, that is in these official bodies that I'm studying, it has great problems, because it has to correct that by saying, aha, we're not being racist. And then when it gives its loyalty to the nation and it makes its patriotic statements and so forth, it has to correct itself and say, we're not being Uncle Tommy-ish. You know, and it is constantly moving back and forth. And over again, I take a number of representative speeches, which I consider to be representative. I, you know, you sort of do a lot of reading, and then you say, aha, this one sort of, and I divide them into parts, and I show a kind of typology that is always present, or an analytical typology that's always present in the speeches, whether they're sermons or addresses, and then demonstrate that in order to get at this duality. Then the next chapter is on the Black Church's morality in conflict. And there I show how there are, the Black Churches were always doing two things, I mean these Black Churches, and that is they had all kinds of commissions and papers, regular studies annually and so forth on the state of the family and the state of our women and our children, education and so forth. There were all kinds of issues like that. And then there were the larger issue of the state of the race. And then the moralities, the relationship, the internal relationship between sort of the state of the race and the morality of racism as a moral problem. And all kinds of other things like alcoholism, and dancing and gambling, and which a lot of energy was placed on these things, but yet I'm dealing with the relationship between them.
Can I interrupt?
Yes, of course.
Okay. I'll just like to lift up one point which I'm profoundly concerned with in your work, and that is the word powerlessness. And we just want to caution you as you pursue this, that I agree based on empirical evidence that the Black community had a sense of powerlessness, the empirical situation. The motif of hope, that is, as Thurman puts it, the tapestry of the Black religious yearning, is that which is non-empirical. So to pick up the clue to power within the Black community goes deeper than the empirical evidence suggests, so that in the face of the broken empirical structures that impose a sense of powerlessness deeper within the hearts and minds of our people was a profound sense of power.
I agree with that.
I'd like to raise a question here, because I don't think there's any empirical evidence here at all. That's the problem. That you're going from a set of speeches to another set of speeches, and you're not looking at the empirical evidence. And I take it that's what you mean in part, Dr. Webb, when you say the paucity of pieces that you're put on the canvas. It reminds me a little of the Fellow's Civil Religion, where you analyze the nation's faith by looking at the presidential addresses of...
I'm not giving an argument for empirical, but I'm saying what I have based it on. Now, if you say that the speeches and so forth of these people are not empirical data, that's okay with me, whatever you call them. That's what I base what I say on.
Yes, right, right. Okay, but now, the point I'm trying to make is if you're going to talk about the social teachings of the church, it would seem to me that you would be concerned also to find out how these things manifest themselves in the actual congregations of the denomination and the lives of the people. Not simply how people formulate those when they're making addresses. And in that sense, I mean, it's not really empirical.
Okay, then in that sense, it is not, and there again, you know, I think that one does need a full-blown sociological analysis or socio-historical analysis. I didn't have the materials or the skills and so forth to do that. I think that there's something very important about the record, the official records of churches. I think that those things are not nothing. Those things are, and therefore I spent 3 years reading minutes of these conferences and going through that kind of primary materials. And it's a very boring kind of reading because it goes on year after, it takes you so long to get through one set of minutes, and then you see, look at all these years ahead, and so many of them look exactly the same over and over again. And so, you know, I mean, that's, but you sort of wander through that, and then the question is, Kina, what kind of sense can I make out of this? Now, this is my effort to sort of make some kind of sense out of that, realizing that it can't possibly be a
lot. Let me give you an example of what happens with these things. Maybe Lewis, sort of with me, and maybe some other, Jim Cohn and others, we were called together by some of the bishops of the church to formulate some social pronouncements for the AME church. A paper on health, a paper on racism, a paper on economic justice, a paper on crime, and all of these things. We had a paper, a position paper, on each of these topics. Now, this is the kind of thing that you would have encountered because they were entered into the minutes of the General Conference of 1976, I think it was. Passed by the conference, approved as the official stand of the conference. They were passed on the last day, the closing moments of the last day after all the bishops have been elected and everybody's gone home and nobody cares anyway. They were put on the shelf. Nobody knows where they are now. But that's what you saying you're encountering and determining to be the social teachings of the AME church. There's a big gap between what happens in public, what happens down at Bethel AME, you know, on Darrell Street at Evanston. A huge gap.
I was just wondering if you also included data from minutes of like the Women's Division missionary societies as to whether the same, as you look at those sermons, I would put in my job in terms of forms critically, you find the same formal elements. Does the same thing happen in terms of with the women's society, or is there a different thrust that comes out of those?
I did a lot of work in reading, and it doesn't appear here. And I would like to this study. I would like at some point to work on something about the tension, which I thought was I feel a real great tension between the women's association and the main bodies of the church. And that tension isn't even subtle at many times. And in fact, at the Baptist Convention, it was the women's organizations that first brought sort of controversial figures to the convention, like Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois and so forth. They first appeared at the women's.
That's interesting.
Later they were, I mean, things like that. Now, the point is, this is not a comprehensive history of the Black Church.
I might say that there's going to be a dissertation on women in the Black Baptist Convention coming out of the University of Rochester. It will be in history under Jenna Macy. It's being done by Evelyn Brooks, who teaches at the University of Maryland. The dissertation will probably be available at the end of the year.
Excuse me, Peter.
You made yourself open, Peter, to some difficulties where you not, in 1984, do something that speaks to also the role of women within formulating on what happens in these social constructs as there is a female dynamic within that in terms of how that, what play that has in terms of the official line of the church.
In formulating the title, yes, it may be helpful for us to see some alternatives you consider, but if not that, at least because of the resonance that you get from the social teaching in mind, yes, the work of trouble, how is it life on life? How do you modify it? How do you stipulate?
That is that the title is simply has been an operational title, and that is a very serious consideration. That is a title. Any suggestions will be glad to accept.
I wondered that too, but not. But maybe not necessarily for the same reasons he's raising. I just I think what you're doing is extremely necessary. And I think we got to do a lot more of that. A few years. A few denominations and so on. And I just wondered if perhaps you might be taking it too far on either side. And if you could find a title and if you could find a way of introducing this so that you do show that it's limited and that you're only speaking about these Baptist denominations in 1890, in 1895, and what's happening there and how they're responding, you would limit yourself in all the ways you're suggesting, you're trying to, okay? But to try to go back before 1890 or to bring it up beyond might invalidate what could be a very useful work.
The beginning was 1890. It isn't a study, a 5-year study or 10-year study. It is.
I understand.
But your point is well taken. Well, the thing I wanted to say about the economics, for instance, is that there's very little discussion in the Black official church
about economics.
And I was very concerned with the economic question. And that is, it just doesn't appear very much at all.
But you have to say that.
I do.
Okay. You see, because you said something about the independence of the church based on its ownership of property and so on.
I do this in the sense of the relative autonomy or the autonomy and dilemma. One thing that gets developed there, it's so difficult to talk about the whole thing, is that the Black church is separated, but they never separated absolutely. But the Black churches, for economic relationships and so forth, remained in significant relationship with the bodies from which they separated. And the getting of mortgages and bank loans and all of that kind of thing, they were heavily helped. And also the training, scholarship money and money for schools, and also providing money for personnel that served Black youth and so forth. Often those kinds of monies came from the white counterparts of the organizations. And so I point to that. Don't deal with it in great detail, but point to it significantly to show that the relationship was always relative autonomy and separation. But not absolute, at least not absolute. Now, let me say one more thing here, and that is the Black conversion that preceded by the independence and Christian reform. What I meant there was that the Black church, the Blacks were not becoming Christian because they perceive the white churches as having distorted Jesus. And so they had to correct Jesus to sort of, and that's what the black tradition out of which the black churches came did. It sort of said that Jesus is not the Jesus of slavery, but Jesus is the liberator or whatever.
But see, that's where I have so much trouble because I never think of slavery. I always think of slavery as an organism that becomes and becomes and becomes and develops, and you're talking about different stages. And see, when I think back to one stage, I would find a contradiction with what you're saying now. That's all I'm...
Okay, but you see, when the literature in the post-slavery period just is filled with a consciousness of us having been a degraded people, morally, socially, and all sorts of And then so much of the orientation was a matter of sort of uplifting the race out of the degradation into which we had been for three centuries. That is at least these people whom I was reading were saying. And
yeah, honestly, I am not an ethicist. I don't even read ethics, really.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I think I'll pass several ideas here that do not fit well in my thinking, and in that you're a member of the society, we want to be sure that you are going to tighten this book with the criticism that has been made up to now. Several statements you made, just generalized statements, could be thrown down immediately, you know, but it would be good for me to have read the statement, the book, the papers first before I make it. So other than wasting my time, which could be wrong. Let me pass on. I do wish it well.
The only statement, you see, every time, and certainly reading the book would help this point,
yes.
is whenever I use the term the black churches, I'm referring to the black churches a la these six denominations.
I think,
though, Peter, that,
three Baptist,
even
three Baptist,
when you say that, you don't escape the criticisms which are being made. For instance, Barrett has asked, where do you start? And if you're using these minutes and so forth, you're starting with the minutes of one year or another year. And we have to know what year are you, minutes are you starting with?
And then
comprehensiveness of the minutes you're looking at? Are you looking, for instance, at the AME Church Review, the magazine? Where you would have lots of the articles and statements of these individuals and the debates concerning social teachings carried out. Now, if you're not looking at the review, you're going to miss this. Now, again, I'm glad to have you go through all those other records. I don't want to go through them. I'd like to know what's in them. But, you need to say that you've looked at this piece and not the other piece. The teachings are the teachings which are extracted from this aspect of the church's life and not the whole of the church's life. And it covers this period of time and not the other period of time.
No, I'm very much aware of the importance of the beginning of the book to set out your limits and what it is that you're doing and what it is that you're not doing. And
Peter, in all fairness to what you've given us here, I want to just come back again to your title, The Black Church's Embodiments of Communal Power. And it seems to me that you make a strong case, and I think it could be demonstrated across the denominational lines, that the variable of independence is a very critical variable for an embodied understanding of communal power. But I think it seems to me that that's very clear in terms of the way it goes across the denominational lines. But I think that in terms of the way blacks understood whites, to say that blacks understood themselves as self-giving to whites at a communal, that is, in terms of all the black churches, at a communal level, and that was embodied at a communal level, it seems to me to maybe be stretching your construct a bit, because there, it seems to me, you get back to the problem that was raised over here by Larry, namely of what happens at a hierarchy level that doesn't filter down and is embodied by the community or by the people in the community.
Well, it's a subtle use of words and stuff like that. The communal power, it is not that blacks are giving themselves to whites. I'm trying to make that clear. It is a relationship that blacks are aiming at. It is a relationship, an interracial relationship.
So it's an ideal, as opposed to.
It is a goal that they are working for. It's a goal which they feel is attainable. It's not an ideal in the sense that it's not attainable.
Yeah, but see, what I'm thinking of is this was the worst lynching period.
No,
this...
I don't care how worse the period was. I mean, I got speeches here on the event of a lynching when the one of the denominations was meeting and virtually on the heels of a lynching, and the kinds of speeches that were made there by the president, and the point being that some people were saying, shouldn't we march on this town and so forth? And then the focus of attention so forth, and no, this would be an act of revenge and so forth. And what we've got to do is to try to transcend this particular event in order to condemn it, but yet not keep open the possibility of the development of some harmonious relationship.
But this is not the case that Riggins is talking about.
Can I, if you want to express that issue.
Yeah, I just want to say that it seems to me that Riggins talking about the perception or the thought of blacks, you're talking about a statement made by a black denominational official in a church gathering of a certain sort, and they're different things. And I don't know why we need to confuse them, so that if the communal power is to be the statement about how black bishops or black church officials of six denominations perceive things when they are addressing the annual conferences, fine, I don't have any problem with that. But then don't tell me that's the conception of communal power that's operating in the black community. They're two different things. That's all
I'm
trying
to say. Speech is just that. It's not the...
We have a different understanding of what a speech is.
Let me raise my question. This is germane to that. I do think that any construct is after the criticism that we are raising here. But at the same time, when you deal with a construct, as you have done, it seems to me that if the construct is too tightly worn, that is woven into a construct that automatically exclude certain other things that need to be said. For example, I was concerned about the understanding of how you are deriving from the construct that you've given one paradigm that deals with the scripture as being the creation, possibly the creation motif, the fatherhood of God, and all, as being the one paradigm that is undergirding the black church. I think that you come out of that because of you're bound to your construct, which is the duality of loyalty to race and nation as being the thing that controls your choice of the creation paradigm. Now, if that, to me, that is saying more about the leaders and the church position papers than it is necessarily the church. But it does kind of put you into a fulfilling of your construct that deals with the duality of loyalty to race and nation. And it puts us into that mindset, which is, it may be germane to that particular mindset, but it does not talk about the whole sweep of the church, per se. And I think that's what's undergirding what I perceive may be the criticism, that it is not the whole church, of black church. There are other traditions that govern, like the Exodus experience. That is a very germane kind of paradigm within the context of the church.
But don't you think, maybe you can help me here. I assume that if you're president of an organization and you are giving the annual address, that in that annual address,